Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Robots Are Coming. And today we will be interviewing Professor Adriana Z. Robertson, Donald N. Pritzker, Professor of Business Law at the University of Chicago Law School. Your specialty is in the intersection of law and finance, including securities law, capital markets regulation, corporate finance, and business law. Prior to joining the University of Chicago Law School, you've held the Honorable Justice Frank Ikobuchi, Chair in Capital Markets Regulation at the University of Toronto Faculty of Law, with a joint appointment in the finance area at the Rotman School of Management. In the autumn quarter of 2019, you were the Daniel R. Fishel and Sylvia M. Neal Distinguished Visiting Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Chicago Law School. My name is Ken Hinn, your host of The Robots Are Coming. Let's get started. So before we begin, I'd like to ask all my guests, could we first start with how you got started during your undergrad, all the way to where you are now in your career?
Yeah, sure. So I started, I was an econ major in college, and I thought that was really great. And I did some RA work for some professors as I was going through. Super interesting. But as I was doing that, it became clear to me that I did not want to, become an econ professor myself. It was very interesting, but a little bit too, let's say, theoretical for my taste. So, I did what a lot of students do when they don't really know what to do after college. I went to law school. And once I got there, I took a class, I took a business organizations class in my 1L spring with a professor named Roberta Romano. And she is amazing. And I realized in the course of taking that class that what I really wanted was her job. I wanted to study the questions she was studying. And so I went to talk to her and I said, "What do I do?" And she said, "Well, you should probably learn something about the real world. So you should probably go do a PhD in finance, and we have this joint JD PhD program. You should do that." Right? And so that's what I did, and the rest is history. So really, I owe all credit to Roberta Romano for where I am today.
That's great. So Professor Romano influenced you to eventually get a PhD in finance from the Yale School of Management and a JD from Yale Law School. And now you are a professor at among the best and most prestigious law schools in the world, the University of Chicago Law School. So before we delve into our next topic, I want to talk about your paper called Passive in Name Only, Delegated Management and Index Investing. I want to talk to you about what you found through that paper and what you did to analyze the landscape of US stock market indices.
Yeah, so just taking a step back, there's been this huge move in the last 10 years or so towards index investing, right? People don't buy individual stocks so much, although they do a little bit, and obviously we have the meme stocks as well. But by and large, what most retail investors are doing is they're buying these big index funds, right? And half of capital now, when we look at domestic equity funds, it's in index funds. Right? So think of your big Vanguard S&P 500 fund or your big iShares, like a BlackRock fund, things like that. And so about, let's say, 5 years ago, the corporate law literature started really focusing on these questions and the implications of what it means to have this big move towards index investing, so-called passive investing. And as I was reading that literature, I just kept thinking to myself, gosh, these indices, they're really important. They're driving all the, and apparently they're changing the whole face of corporate governance. So I better find the paper that's going to explain to me what these indices are and how they're constructed and how they make decisions, because they seem really important. So I kept looking for that paper, and then I realized it didn't seem to exist, so I had to go and write it. And so that's what I did. So the way that I went about doing that was I just downloaded from sort of data providers that are pretty common, the list of all of the indices that were either being used as a benchmark for a mutual fund, or that was the underlying index that was being tracked by an index fund. And then I just went and I downloaded the methodology document for each one of these indices, and I read them. I just wanted to know what they said. Right? And from there, I kind of discovered that this world was a lot more complicated and not nearly as passive as people seem to think.
And You also mentioned you turned to ETFs and found that a substantial faction of these funds track indices that they or their affiliates create. Could you walk us through what that meant?
Yeah, so again, when people think about, first of all, when I think when most people think about ETFs and index funds, they kind of use those words interchangeably. They're like, oh, just buy an ETF. They're passive. They just track the market. So that's great. Like, you get lots of diversification, low fees. It's the best thing you can do with your money. And in some cases, that's true. Some ETFs are widely diversified and low fee, but not all of them. And so one of the sort of funny things that I found when I dug in specifically to the ETF subsample is that, as you said, a surprising number of them to me were tracking an index that the fund or one of its affiliates actually creates. So, what this means is rather than the traditional idea of passive investing, I think what most people have in mind is that, like, there's some index out there in the world, it like falls from the sky, right? And the fund goes and tracks it. And of course, what is an index? It's just a list of stocks, right? You've got two columns. There's a list of stocks in the first column, and the second column is just the weight of each one of those stocks, right, in your portfolio. And that falls from the sky. The fund goes and tracks it, and therefore it's sort of passive. When the fund itself or one of its affiliates is creating the index, well, then that's essentially like my right hand makes the list, and my left hand tracks the list, and I'm going to call that passive. Right, so that's really weird. It's hard to come up with a conception of passive that would be consistent with that. Right, so there's really this really broad spectrum from something that does more or less approximate trying to track the whole universe of securities or at least of stocks to I've got the guy sitting down the hall that makes the list, which doesn't seem all that different from having an active fund manager. Right. The difference is, does he sit down the hall or does he sit in my office? Not clear why, from an investor's perspective, that should matter very much.
And I'm curious to ultimately what your paper ultimately shed light on the financial markets and what implications it may have for investor protection.
Yeah, so I'll give you one very straightforward example of this. There's a lot of conversation right now in the corporate governance space about this sort of universal ownership idea, right? So if you take seriously the idea that all of half of money and maybe in the future all of money, depends on how aggressive you want to be with your forecasts, but if you take seriously this idea that everybody just owns the market because that's what these index funds are doing, then you can come to either a very optimistic place or a very pessimistic place, right? The optimistic place you can come to, which some scholars have come to, is this idea that, well, look, if an asset manager owns the market, then they're going to internalize externalities. They're going to take into account things like carbon emissions that cause global warming, because after all, global warming is really bad for the economy. And so these asset managers will do this sort of systemic or systematic stewardship where they try to take all these things into account. So the optimistic story is the growth of index investing and these giant asset managers that own the market is going to, solve all of our problems. Then there's a pessimistic take on this, which is no, this is common ownership. These asset managers, because of this, they're going to engage in all sorts of anti-competitive behavior. It's going to drive up prices, which is going to be good for profits, but bad for consumers, and it's going to be bad for innovation, and we don't like that. So you can get to two very different policy outcomes from this belief that everybody owns the market. But of course, if it turns out that you don't own the market, because all of these indices are actually very different from each other, and we can't just assume that all of the money that's tracking indices owns the market and does the same stuff, then that kind of goes away, right? So it sort of pours a little bit of cold water on both of these fights, both of which have, I think, pretty first order policy implications.
And I think they do very much have a lot of policy implications. And that's why I wanted to move on to your next paper on the misuses of the S&P 500. You've had a lot to say in that paper. And I do want to make an outside comment about how there are so many monopolies and corruption within Wall Street. So I'm curious to hear what you found through your research and the misuses of the S&P 500?
Yeah, so you know, I want to be very clear. That paper, which is sort of a deep dive into one particular index, which is probably the best known index, at least in the US equity markets, the S&P 500. I don't want to claim that there's anything wrong with the index itself, rather that the way people are using the index has problems, right? Hence the misuses of this, you know, totally fine product. It's a product, it is what it is. But so the first misuse, in my view, is this idea that if you buy a mutual fund or an ETF that tracks the S&P 500, you're buying a passive product. Right? So why do I think that that's just deeply confused? Well, one of the things that I do in that paper is I go and try to estimate the extent of discretionary management of that index. Right. So again, people think of the S&P 500 as being passive. It's not. And if you read the documentation of the index carefully, it becomes very clear that there's an index committee and their job is subject to certain criteria. They pick and choose which companies get added to the index. So you might remember, if some of your listeners are kind of more tech focused folks, you might remember a couple of years ago, there was a lot of chatter about when Tesla was going to get added to the S&P 500. Why is there chatter about something like this? Well, because it's a discretionary decision. You don't know when the committee is going to make its choice. Right? And so I kept getting calls from different people because I'm sort of obsessed with index construction about when this was going to happen and what it was going to mean. And ultimately, it did get added to the index and its price jumped, as one would expect. So once we see that the index is discretionarily created, then it follows that anybody whose investments track the index has a discretionary portfolio. Right? And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with, you know, hiring a portfolio manager to manage your investments. We should just be clear about the fact that that's what it means to own an S&P 500 fund. Right? It means that you are giving this index committee the power to select your portfolio. So that's sort of the first, maybe most important misuse, certainly when it comes to investors. And then there's some other ones as well, like the idea that we should just use the S&P 500 as kind of the default benchmark for any investment, right? So somebody goes out and, you know, they're either running a pension fund or they're running some other mutual fund, and we're going to check how well our asset manager did by comparing it to some benchmark, like say the S&P 500. Well, there's a problem with that, which is it's not clear why you should be comparing yourself to this one particular discretionary portfolio when, you know, who knows if your risk profile is the same, who knows? I mean, it might be right, but more likely it's not. And then, of course, the same thing goes for companies themselves. Right? So the idea that companies that are on the index are required to disclose their performance relative to the index, in the Form SK requires it, is just a bizarre and puzzling thing to do. And I try to show empirically why that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
And I know in your paper, you propose changes to current regulatory regimes to correct these misuses. Could you walk us through what, let's say, the executive branch should do, the legislature should do, and how what next steps we should be doing?
So some of the stuff can be done just through, you know, executive, through rulemaking at the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC. So, you know, right now there's a requirement that mutual funds disclose their performance relative to an appropriate broad-based securities index. And the overwhelmingly most popular choice is the S&P 500. You could just get rid of that. Right? There are alternative ways to look at performance, and I think technology can actually help with that. And of course, the same is true for this requirement that companies disclose their performance relative to the index if they're on the index. I mean, you just get rid of that. So that's simple rulemaking at the agency level could deal with that. There's also a more interesting question, I think, from my perspective, about this idea more broadly about passive investing. First of all, you know, should we allow funds to use the word passive at all? I'm of the view that we shouldn't. because after all, somebody is still making the index. It doesn't just fall out of the sky, and making an index involves an exercise of discretion. And so to me, it's sort of misleading to use that phrase. It's so poorly defined, and I would say it's so poorly defined that it is effectively meaningless, and is much more likely to obscure than it is to enlighten investors. And then on top of that, when we think about these sort of more specialized indices, so closer to either the affiliates, right, that make the index that an ETF tracks, or even just a specialized index that I write about in the passive and name only paper, a colleague and I wrote a separate follow-up paper where we argued that actually those indices, specialized indices, they're not just similar to investment advisors, they are investment advisors under the securities law. So if you just look at the statute and you look at the precedents and you look at all of the other stuff, other law, right, whether it be agency commentary, judicial decisions, and the like, they just satisfy the definition of investment advisor. So a pretty simple solution there is that we think the SEC should, start doing that. That's probably going to require some tailored rulemaking on the commission's part. I'm delighted to say that this summer, the SEC actually did put out a request for comment about index providers to solicit feedback from the industry and others about how it could go about doing that and what that might look like. So there might be movement on that front at some point, but they have a very busy agenda, so it's hard to know.
From your perspective, Professor Robertson, what do you think companies and industries, whether it's in tech or companies around the country, how will they respond to that comment from the SEC?
Well, the comment letters are online, so you can anybody who wants to read them can read them. It may not surprise you to learn that industries very often do not want to be regulated. And so, look, I think it is certainly fair to say that what an index is providing to a mutual fund is not the full suite of advisory services that you might expect from, an investment advisor. If you go down the street to somebody who's got their shingle and you ask them to manage your portfolio for them. I'm not sure that's a reason to ignore the fact that they still satisfy the basic requirements, and there are still these potential risks for investors. Another way to think about it is, look, if we're not worried that the folks that are picking the portfolios that mutual funds are tracking, if we're not worried about that because we think there are other guardrails in place, then I don't understand why we're regulating this for active mutual funds and not for the sort of passive, scare quotes, index funds, right? Either this is useful and helping investors or it's not. But what I find really odd is this mismatch and the fact that right now we treat them differently, even though the activities are identical.
I also want to move on to another paper that you wrote called Advisors by Another Name that you wrote in 2021 in collaboration with Professor Mahoney of UVA School of Law. And in that paper, you talk about the rise of index funds reshaping the modern American capital markets. And I'm curious what you argued in that paper and what you found out.
Yeah, so that's the one. That's the paper I was just talking about, where we go through the law and the precedents, and we say, hence the title, Advisors by Another Name. It's not that they are like advisors, it's that they are advisors. And so
Well,
we
that's
don't,
great. Yep.
no, this is convenient though. You see, this is convenient because it means that Congress doesn't have to pass a new law. As I'm sure you know, it is very difficult for Congress to pass laws because there's all sorts of, well, now we've got an election coming up. Anyway, Congress is very busy. But it is easier, still not super easy, but easier for an agency to, take action on the basis of existing law. And so once we understand that actually the current Advisors Act allows and arguably even kind of requires the SEC to take action in this area, then that is much more, well, it makes me much more hopeful that we can get progress on this.
Is there a reason why that this form of regulation hasn't been moving or prioritized right now? Is it because of the Biden administration, or is it because of the SEC, or what is the root cause of this?
Yeah, so I mean, I don't think it's the Biden administration, and I don't think I don't want to blame anyone. I think really what happened was this was a very gradual development over like 40, 50 years. So index funds first started, sort of first inkling of them in like the 1970s, and they grew really gradually. And so, and really early on, it was primarily tracking pretty broad-based diversified indices like, say, the S&P 500. And it was only over, you know, in the last 10, 15 years maybe or so, much more recently that we got this explosion in these very specialized indices, right? So now what is increasingly happening is rather than there being some index out there in the world that, you know, a fund goes and tracks, I come to you, I'm a mutual fund, you know, sponsor, and I come to you and I say, hey, Ken, I'd really like for you to make an index for me with the following characteristics. I want it to be small cap tech companies. I want you to make sure that the CEO of the company has already founded another company. I also want you to make sure that, you know, the revenues are between X and Y. And I want you to, while you're doing that, you know, make sure that you get a good mix of, you know, gender, because I want you to make sure there's enough women and make sure there's also some people of color on there. Like, you can do that, right? And then you, my index provider, say, sure, I can do that. You write down this list of companies that meet those criteria, and then I pay you a licensing fee, and I have my mutual fund track your index. Right? And so that index, I mean, that's not a real one, I just made that up, but they can be awfully specific. That index has no independent existence other than so that my fund can track it, right? Like, that's what's really going on here. And that's something that's relatively new, right? Relatively new development. And so it's not the commission's fault that the rules that they've been working from, right? It takes time for these things to catch up sometimes, let me put it that way. And so what I have been trying to do in these papers, in the one you mentioned, and even in some of the other ones we've been talking about, like passive and name only and the misuses of the S&P 500, is just sort of like, jog people a little bit to say, hey, your preconceptions about how these things work, because it is maybe how they used to be, or maybe it just wasn't worth thinking about it that much because it wasn't that important, right? The market has changed. This has become really important for us to understand kind of deeply. And once we do that, we realize that some of our status quo rules don't make as much sense anymore, and we should update based on that. And now, it is true that the current SEC has a very busy regulatory agenda. They've got all sorts of things they're trying to tackle. So, you know, I don't know if this is ultimately going to make the cut, but I was certainly heartened to see that there, you know, it did make it at least as far as a request for comment.
I do agree that the landscape of corporate or securities laws has changed. And I do want to talk about another paper that you wrote called Hidden Agendas in Shareholder Voting. And that there's a claim that was made that it says, quote, nothing in either corporate or securities law requires companies to notify investors what they'll be voting on before the record date for a shareholder meeting. Could you walk us through what you found and what hidden agendas you found within these shareholder meetings?
Yeah, sure. So that was a super fun paper that I wrote with my friend Scott Hurst, who's at BU. And so, you know, an important fact about corporate law is that the main mechanism for corporate governance is shareholder voting, right? Just like we think about democracy, you know, this is like a not a perfect analogy, but it's the closest thing we've got. You know, we have elections, we vote for, you know, who's going to be our representatives and who's going to be, you know, the president and so on all the way down to the local level. And we have a sort of an analogy to this in corporate governance. There is an annual meeting where shareholders vote They elect the board of directors, and then it's the board of directors' job to, hire the CEO and pay the CEO, and then the CEO hires the rest of the executives, and they run the company. And so in some ways, it's analogous to what we see in the political space. And just like in a, say, congressional election, there's a voter registration deadline, right? You have to register to vote at a certain point, and if you miss the deadline, in some states, that's it. And in other states, you can register day of, but anyway, it gets complicated. When it comes to shareholder voting, there's something called the record date. And the record date is a bit like the voter registration deadline. You have to own the shares on the record date in order to be eligible to vote at the annual meeting. And there's a time gap of several weeks between the record date and the meeting date. And so it turns out that companies are not required to disclose the agenda, right, for the meeting. So you can think of that as like the ballot items, right? If you live in California, you have all of these, referenda questions, all of these ballot items. It's like not knowing what's going to be on the ballot at the time you have to go and register to vote. Right? So you might say, well, am I going to bother registering to vote or not? I don't even know what's on the agenda. Maybe it's not worth my time. Right? Now you might say, well, that's bad. Everybody should just register anyway, because voting's important. What are you doing not registering to vote just because you don't see the agenda? Well, it turns out that a lot of big mutual funds, so now we're back to talking about these big asset managers, they engage in what's called share lending. Right? They lend out the shares in the portfolio to earn some extra income. There's nothing wrong with share lending. It's actually very valuable. It's the reason it's also possible to have short sellers in the market is because somebody's willing to lend. And so all of this comes together to mean that asset managers, at the time they have to decide if they want to recall or lend their shares, they don't know what they're going to be voting on yet. Why is that? Well, because it turns out share lending is a misnomer. It's not a loan at all. You've actually sold the share and you have to get it back. So the punchline of all of this is that investors don't know at the time they have to make this decision what they're going to be voting on. That's a problem, we think, because if we think corporate governance is important, then parties should know what they're voting on. And this, by the way, is also tied up in one of these old sort of anachronistic views of the market. So just a fun anecdote, I was telling a friend of mine about this paper and this project, and he's a guy who works in the real world. His job is to draft these things for a public company. And I said to him, this is really weird, right? Like, the agenda should be known in advance. And he looked at me and he said, Adri, how do you want us to send these out before we know who to send it to? Because the whole point of the record date is to figure out who's entitled to vote. And I laughed and I said, oh my God, this is like stuck in the 1970s when these actually used to go out by mail, as opposed to posting it online, which is where every investor is going to see it anyway. And then you don't need to know the identity of the investors, right? You just put it online. Anybody in the world can see it and the investors can decide on that basis. So there's all sorts of places, I think, in our regulatory space in the financial markets where we're just stuck. Our mindset is stuck like 30, 40, 50 years ago, and we need to kind of pull it into the present day.
And also in your paper, you mentioned as a simple solution to eliminate hidden agendas to urge the SEC to, quote, amend its proxy rules to require public companies to file proxy statements at least 5 days before the record date for the meeting. I'm curious to hear how you came up with that idea, and is there something in history that's related to your proposal?
Yeah, so we thought of that as being like the least obtrusive possible solution, which is literally like just post it on the internet like a few days earlier. You have to send it to the printer anyway, because these things actually still get mailed out by snail mail. Like, come on, surely if you're sending it to the printer to get printed and stuck in envelopes and mailed to people, you could just post it on the internet. How hard could that be? Now, I think it's a reasonable question to ask, is 5 days enough? Maybe we need more time. We're certainly, Scott and I are very open to extending that. We wanted to give a proposal that was the most inobtrusive thing we could do, because we do understand that corporate secretaries are busy right? They've got a lot on their plate. Change is hard, right? Like change is always hard. And so the least costly way to get the benefits was what we were trying to go for there.
And my second question is, was there an event in history that you'd like to make parallel to that proposal?
Oh gosh. So anybody, just like, I'm just going to keep extending this analogy. Just like there's all sorts of like quirks and problems when it comes to counting ballots in democratic political elections, there have been all sorts of snafus when it comes to proxy voting over the years. And you know, this goes back to like the 1960s and the 1970s. There's a whole cluster of issues that is known as proxy plumbing among scholars in this area, and you know, among regulators and commentators and the like. It turns out that basically our entire corporate governance system is held together by like duct tape and spit. It's really quite remarkable. So you know, one potential reaction to our paper is to say, yeah, the proxy plumbing system is a mess. Everybody knows that. The whole thing's held together by duct tape and spit. Let's reform the whole thing. And that is certainly, I mean, I don't think Scott and I disagree with any of that. I guess our hope is that that seems unlikely, at least in the short run. That would be a really big undertaking. We could try to fix everything. But in the meantime, maybe we can just do this one small patch, right? To try to paper over this particular problem, because we do think that it's a pretty low cost. It's like adding 13 words to an existing rule. It's like post the thing online, like a couple of days early. It's not that hard. Maybe we can do this whole patch thing. And then later we can think about doing version 2.0 of, you know, proxy plumbing, because right now it is a bit tenuous.
I mean, it sounds very tenuous indeed, and I think there should be more technologists and any listener listening to this podcast to help out with this posting 5 days before the deadline. And to that statement, Professor, what do you think technologists who are listening should do to help out with public policy or investing for consumers and investors to create more insights on the U.S. market?
Oh gosh. So there are so many things that we could use people's help with. I think, you know, one challenge is that maybe this has fallen a little bit in the last 6 months or so since the crypto winter, but I think for the longest time, for a long time, technologists were really, really excited about this like cool new technology, right? Blockchain is going to change the world. It became a bit of a punchline, I think it's fair to say. That you know, oh well, you know, the answer is blockchain. And I don't, I mean, I think that there probably are some valid applications in the corporate governance securities regulation space. But what I think would be really the most valuable would be to sit down and actually try to talk to the people working in this space right now. So something that I find really valuable as an academic is to talk to like corporate secretaries and to talk to asset managers and to like understanding where people are coming from and what is it that is holding back these improvements today. Because, you know, these are really smart people that generally also want the system to work efficiently. They just are operating with constraints. And, you know, they're worried that because so many things are sort of, is like a Rube Goldberg, you know, machine going on. It's like sometimes you move this one little thing and it actually has really important implications somewhere way on the other side of the board that you didn't notice. And sometimes I think both academics and technologists, we kind of want to gloss over those things and just say, no, I've got this great new solution that's going to come from on high. It's going to fix all the problems. Don't worry about that. You guys are just standing in the way. You're being intransigent. You know, whatever.
And Professor, you mentioned technologists should talk to policymakers about this. And what it seems to me is similar to what President Roosevelt did with John D. Rockefeller when the oil trusts were coming up, and Roosevelt agreed to have a conversation with this oil giant. Maybe there should be the same thing with the 21st century, where the president agrees to talk with the big trusts of today. What do you think of that, and do you think that that can be accomplished?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's not quite what I was getting at. Although, I mean, I guess it could be. I gotta say, antitrust is not my wheelhouse. What I had in mind was more kind of like individual people who are sort of steeped in this space and have all these great ideas about, you know, ways to innovate. I think it is fair to say that right now, a lot of the creative juices in this space seem to be spent trying to get around existing rules. We certainly see that in a lot of places. And it might be more productive to try to work together to make sure that the rules are shaped in a way that is sort of better for society as a whole going forward. I know that's sort of a Pollyanna-ish request, though, because there's just not that much money in it, as opposed to the money that can be made in other places.
And with the rise of new technologies, as you mentioned, such as blockchain, quantum, and ways to better optimize the market system, what do you anticipate should be done in terms of public policy to maybe regulate some of these new technologies that are going to be popping up?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, the crypto space, I think, is still up for grabs. Is it going to end up with the SEC? Is it going to end up with the CFTC? Is it going to end up somewhere else entirely? What are we going to do with crypto exchanges? They seem a little bit different from, you know, like a traditional stock exchange, like the New York Stock Exchange. What's going to happen to those? I think it's a really interesting area right now. And I do worry that to some extent, folks are talking past each other. Not everyone, but some folks are. And there's a lot. I certainly noticed that on Twitter, there are sort of a lot of, let's say, more heat than light that sometimes emerges in these discussions.
And I could see the same thing. There's a lot of polarization on social media websites, on Facebook, on Twitter, and the next era of social media, which is TikTok. So I definitely agree with that. And before we finally sign off on our interview, I wanted to ask you if you had any lasting words for technologists, public policymakers, and what you anticipate the future would look like, and also what papers and works that you have coming up that you'd like to share to our audience.
Oh, gosh. You know that old line, predictions are hard, especially about the future. So I don't make predictions about the future, only about the past.
Got it.
That's a joke. Those aren't predictions. But I mean, look, the only thing I can say for sure is that the markets are always changing, and it's really, really hard to predict what's going to happen next. I think that we've seen some super interesting changes in the last decade or so. Simultaneously, the rise of these giant institutional investors, often associated with these big index funds, but also retail investors making a huge comeback, right, in the sort of meme stock space, but also just more generally when it comes to retail trading, started with kind of Robinhood, but also in other places. And guessing what's going to happen next, gosh, I don't know. Another space that is clearly changing, but I don't know where it's going to land, is, of course, ESG. Right? So investors are increasingly concerned about environmental, social, and governance issues. I don't know where that's going to land, right? There's a backlash right now against ESG. We'll see where it goes. I think it's a super interesting space. I think it's something that folks should be paying attention to. It's another place where I think a thoughtful technology can actually help us when it comes to, you know, trying to see to what extent companies that are making environmental or social claims or promises to their investors, and to try to see if they're actually following through on those promises. I think that there could be some really interesting technological innovations that could help us with those problems. I would love to see what's going to happen on that front. But, you know, I guess we'll just have to talk again in 10 years and see what happens.
Yeah, we'll see in 10 years, and hopefully the future is bright. And on that end, do you have any papers, works, or anything you'd like to share to our audience because both my audience and I would love to read your work.
Oh, I got a bunch of projects on the go. I've got a couple of ESG related projects. There's one that's coming out shortly on aggregating ESG, how to think about, these promises at a fund level, since a lot of ESG promises are being made at the mutual fund level instead of individual company level. And then, some other projects related to, well, to ESG and corporate governance more broadly. More work on index funds, because I've always got more work on index funds. It's kind of like my first true love, so I can't quite let it go. So there's a handbook chapter that's coming out shortly on that, and some other work, some empirical work on both S&P 500 funds and on index funds and ETFs more generally. Their drafts are typically available on my website, so I always welcome feedback.
And we'll always give feedback and look at your works indeed. So thank you so much, Professor Robertson, for having this wonderful conversation. And thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode of The Robots Are Coming. Next time, we'll have even more great professors like Professor Robertson here speaking on topics of corporate law, regulation, and entrepreneurship. So make sure you subscribe to The Robots Are Coming wherever you're listening to, and tell all your friends to do that as well. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you.